Since the 1st of April, TNI, in collaboration with allies, has brought together experts and activists to discuss how the COVID-19 pandemic health crisis exposes the injustices of the global economic order and how it must be a turning point towards creating the systems, structures, and policies that can always protect those who are marginalized and allow everyone to live with dignity. The following is a recording of a webinar that featured a dialogue between Rob Wallace, author of Big Farms Make Big Flu, and agrarian justice activists from Myanmar, Palestine, Indonesia, and Europe.
Okay. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Wonderful to see people joining from across all the time zones, and thanks to those who are up very early or very late to be with us. So I'd like to welcome you today to our webinar on COVID-19 and food systems. Thank you very much for joining us today, everyone. My name is Katie Sandwell. I'm from the Transnational Institute. And today we'll be joined by five speakers who are going to help us to understand some of the complex relationships between this present moment of crisis and pandemic and our food systems more broadly. So today we'll have with us Rob Wallace, Ari Kurniavati, Moayad Basharat, Paula Joya, and Sai Samkam. And I'll introduce them in detail in a moment. So I just wanted to tell you briefly, for those who don't already know, a little bit about TNI, the Transnational Institute. So the Transnational Institute is an international activist think tank. We're committed to acting as a point of connection between progressive intellectuals and movements for transformative change and for social justice. So to that end, we regularly publish new research and other publications, and we organize events in the normal course of things to help develop our collective analysis of the political moment. So in this particular and unusual political moment, the form that that is taking is this series of weekly webinars. Some of you may have joined some of the previous webinars in the preceding weeks. And the webinars are taking place right now, each week on Wednesdays at this time. And they're addressing different dimensions and different elements of the current crisis. And at the end today, I will tell you about the upcoming webinars as well. You can also, of course, subscribe to our newsletter at tni.org to get updates. And if you missed any of the previous webinars and are interested, you can catch them on our YouTube channel. I'm really pleased to let you know today that today's webinar will also be interpreted into French and into Spanish by a wonderful team of interpreters. So thank you very much to Emily, to David, Monica, and Maxime for organizing the interpretation for us and making it possible for more people to participate in that way. You can see, or you will see in a moment in the chat, the links to the French and Spanish broadcast to this webinar, so feel free to share those. And I'd like to welcome everyone who's listening over those channels as well. Just to let you know about the format today, we're going to start with an intervention from Rob Wallace, followed by the other four speakers responding and sharing some of the details about the impacts of COVID-19 in their work and in their communities. We'll then come back to Rob briefly and then move to some questions from the floor. So this is where you can engage a little bit, and we will give the panelists a chance to respond. You should see at the bottom of your screen a Q&A option. That's where you can submit your questions. We'll be sorting through them. We obviously will only be able to ask a small selection of them to the panelists, but we will be keeping the questions and using them for future reference. So please do share your questions there. You'll see that you also have a chat option. That's where we're sharing different links, and we'll be sharing further reading and resources throughout the webinar there. You're welcome to put thoughts and questions in there as well, but those will be answered by the other participants. So that's an ongoing discussion, whereas if you want to pose a question directly to the panelists, that's the Q&A. And finally, I wanted to let you know if you're on Twitter or on other social media, you're welcome to share your thoughts there as well. We're using the hashtag TNIWebinars, and feel free to share reflections and feedback there. So, I think that's the general housekeeping for the day, and I think that we should have most of our participants in through the door now. Welcome to everyone. I'd now like to introduce to you Rob Wallace. Rob is a researcher at the Agroecology and Rural Economics Research Corps. He's based in the U.S., and he's the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu, as well as a co-author of Neoliberal Ebola, Modeling Disease Emergence from Finance to Forest and Farm, as well as Clear-Cutting Disease Control, Capital-Led Deforestation, Public Health Austerity, and Vector-Borne Infection. Rob has consulted on health and on disease with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, as well as the Centers for Disease Control in the US. He's also a member of the Pandemic Research for the People initiative. So thank you very much for joining us, Rob. Welcome. And can I ask you to start us off by telling us a little bit about the situation we're in today and about how we got here?
Sure. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here in spite of our present circumstances. And I wanted to begin with the present status of the pandemic. The Johns Hopkins Global Map has us this morning at 2 million confirmed COVID cases worldwide and 128,000 dead. Given the count some countries are reporting as suspected cases, this confirmed caseload is likely 5 to 10 times an underestimate. So at worst, as many as 20 million people have to this point been infected, some worse than others. For the worse, with uneven testing across the globe and some areas stretched to medical capacity, deaths are also likely undercounted. More than a quarter of the confirmed cases are situated here in the United States, with large outbreaks in Europe and the Middle East. The Global South is already beginning its run up the epic curve in a context of comparatively lesser public health capacity, fewer household resources for sheltering in place, and a wider array of underlying comorbidities, that is, other health conditions that can complicate a COVID infection. Indeed, as occurred for the HIV epidemic in the most impoverished areas, both global north and south, other matters, including getting food on the table, may be more pressing than what many infected may gamble is only a passing shortness of breath. Now, that all said, COVID isn't merely business as usual. We see some telling reversals. Britain is accepting shipments of masks from Vietnam. Cuba sent doctors to NATO member Italy. And Senegal is turning around COVID tests in 4 hours, while in the US, such tests, even when available, are taking up to 10 days. These telltales are underway during what the world systems theorists describe as a major shift in the cycles of capital accumulation, which have structured much of the world order the past 500 years. And the present pandemic serves as a marker of such a shift, as a shockingly immediate precipice as well. So here we have the United States on the tail end of its cycle of capital accumulation, turning capital back to money for the wealthiest. That is, it's cashing out at this point. Outside its military budget, it's not really investing newly into the infrastructure of global empire. American power, for instance, was up until this outbreak on the hook for cleaning up pandemics that capital the world over had helped create. The US tasked itself with keeping the global system on the same developmental path, despite the ultimately unsustainable and frankly hideous destruction to land and people that path represents. So defunding the World Health Organization, as the US did yesterday, isn't an exercise in imperial might. It's a white flag. It's a capitulation to the American role up to this point. Domestically, the US failures to respond to its own outbreak are more than missteps by the administration and were programmed in decades ago as the shared commons of public health were simultaneously neglected and sold off. A country captured by the regimen of individualized just-in-time public health, which is an utter contradiction, is now presently barely having enough hospital beds and equipment for normal operations, is by definition unable to marshal the resources necessary to pursue the scale of disease suppression that a COVID outbreak demands. Indeed, many a New Yorker denied access to critical care beds and now gasping for breath on their couch at home has much more in common with a West African infected with Ebola in a structurally adjusted healthcare system than any other New Yorker wealthy enough to pay for medical care on demand. I mean, 2,000 New Yorkers were found dead in their homes the first 8 days this month. Rural areas here are also starting to get pummeled. Louisa County in Iowa, which is home to a Tyson Company meatpacking plant through which COVID burned right through, is hosting more cases of COVID per capita than New York State. The county, which is home to 11,000 people, has neither a hospital nor a practicing physician living there. And in other words, to visit, you're going to have to bring your copy of Where There Is No Doctor. China, in contrast, is on the front end of its cycle of accumulation. It is invested in building the infrastructure, including global public health. It needs to turn money into capital and imperial might. This isn't to absolve China of its public health ills, as we'll discuss further, but we should note that the structural impulse there is different. Indeed, upon an initial stumble, China moved to eradicate COVID from Hubei, the province of origin, by deploying 40,000 medical staff and conducting comprehensive contact tracing and testing. Now, beyond this contrast of two giants, the question is why some countries escaped the worst of the outbreak. And that's worth commenting on. I mean, there's a matter of geography. How close to an epicenter? South America and Africa are starting up late this way, but even countries bordering China escaped the worst of it. Now, it helps if a government both prepares the country during the advance warning it's been given and sees the shared commons as still part of the purview of governance. I mean, like, what a concept, right? Taiwan, for instance, tests people at the airport for COVID-19, disinfects their suitcases, drives each person separately to their destination in a government-provided taxi, and gives each arrival one phone app that tells them where in their area they're staying that they can purchase a mask, and another app, which is slightly creepy, that lists local infections and their case histories. Iceland aggressively tests its population and isolates the positive cases. It deploys detectives to trace any infection. Those in contact with the case are also sequestered, so that if any of these people prove to be infected, they're already in quarantine. The rest of the country goes about its business, walking free outside without masks. Vietnam provides comprehensive health care to nearly the entirety of its population, and unlike, say, Louisa County in Iowa, has doctors and nurses in every community. So along with the typical border protocols, like China, whole buildings are quarantined should a case be detected, but the building is also provided three meals a day. Apartment buildings host whole body sanitizing stations at all entrances. Empty hotels are used as quarantine sites where doctors make house calls. Everybody wears a mask. And unlike the US, where the federal government set off a black market bidding war for ventilators between its states, there are few, if any, reports out of Vietnam of price gouging, panic buying, or hoarding. Now, that all said, all countries are in for a rough ride with the global economy already falling toward a recession before the outbreak began. Disease and deficits are interacting. Those countries pummeled worst by the pandemic will find themselves farther in the fiscal hole once the economic fallout begins in earnest. In an effort to fix outbreak and economy at the same time, we find the grim calculus of capital attempting to push the two crises of its own making onto the indigenous and the poorest workers worldwide. Brazil, under Bolsonaro, even before the Amazonian fire comes immediately to mind, but also in the US, the government is aiming to reduce the already criminal wages immigrant farm workers are making as a kind of pandemic relief for agricultural companies. Now, our series of cycles of accumulation, the US cashing out and China ramping up, impacted COVID's very origins. Over the past 40 years, China chose to engage in a massive shifts in land use and migration to domestically feed and pay its population. These shifts had considerable impact on decoupling and then recoupling traditional ecologies into these new configurations that had a profound effect on economy and epidemiology alike. So we see post-economic liberalization in China, the rise of multiple strains of new influenzas, including H5N1, H6N1, H7N9, H9N2, as well as SARS-1, and now an explosion in cases of African swine fever, which killed half of China's hog last year. Now, there's some controversy as to COVID's local origins, but the genetics of the virus, SARS-2, show it to be a recombinant of a bat coronavirus and a pangolin strain that subsequently went through some attuning to the human immune system, whether before that happened or before the Wuhan outbreak or during it. But clearly, agriculture had a role to play in this process, even if that central Wuhan market didn't. Somehow, the virus got from one of the many coronaviruses documented to circulate among a variety of bat species in central China into Wuhan proper. To claim agriculture has no impact as China's moving toward as an official position, or absurdly, if the virus didn't originate in China at all, would position opponents of agriculture's role in a pretty precarious position. I mean, how do you explain the move from bats through pangolins through perhaps another intermediate species such as hog into humans without bringing up agriculture or logging or mining? As there's a Scripps Institute study shows that despite rumors, the genetics don't support a lab accident. Now, in all likelihood, in expanding an expanding regional circuit of production maneuvered both the increasingly formalized wild food sector and industrial livestock production further into China's hinterlands, where both sectors increasingly encountered bat reservoirs. And so these peri-urban loops are growing in extent and population, and they can increase the interface and spillover between wild non-human populations and newly urbanized rural areas. These new geographies also reduce the kind of environmental complexity with which these forests can disrupt the transmission of deadly viruses, as we would like our forests to do. They do work for us when we allow them to exist. Now, that regional circuit of production of COVID's likely origins, forest, peri-urban to city, is reproduced around the world. It's not just China. And it offers a broader framework by which to organize our thinking about outbreaks nearly everywhere. So we have SARS-1 and 2, Ebola, Zika, yellow fever, African swine fever, avian swine influenza, Nipah virus, Q fever, among others, and historically HIV, all originated or reemerged somewhere along such expanding circuits of production, whether in the forest or in the new peri-urban continuum or in factory farms or processing plants near or in cities. Many such new ecologies are driven by imperial or neoliberal imposition. They're not just emerging out of nowhere. So clearly, infectious diseases aren't merely matters of the virus itself, but also the context in which they emerge. Indeed, looking toward the future, we find that coronaviruses are only one of many pathogens developing in such an agroeconomic context. What we are suffering today is already in motion somewhere else, many times over. So these are like viral hurricanes lining up in the Atlantic Ocean, one after the other. So what to do? As perhaps a prompt for our conversation today, I'll touch upon some possibilities, if only as a series of rhetorical questions. Are we prepared to rebuild the town economies that permit farmers and fisher folk around the world the autonomy they need to source local inputs without destroying wilderness? Can we learn to learn from indigenous groups how to treat a landscape as much as a matter of our ethos as a source of food? Will we finally abandon settler ideologies? Will we reintroduce ourselves back into Earth's cycles of regeneration? Can we rediscover our sense of individuation, who we are, in multitudes of people beyond what state and capital offer us, like on this call? Are we prepared to fight to reclaim rural and forest landscapes in local waters that agribusiness has turned into sacrifice zones for global capital? Will we aim to defeat agribusiness as both a mode of production and a political opponent, from its lobbying in state capitals to its campaigns in killing environmental activists along neoliberal frontiers of the forest edge? And I believe these questions are the fires we must walk through in order to be able to introduce the now suddenly obvious strategies in pandemic prevention. Among them, we need to protect the forest complexity that keeps deadly pathogens from lining up livestock and human hosts for a straight shot onto the world's travel network. We need to reintroduce the livestock and crop diversities and reintegrate animal and crop farming at scales that keep pathogens from ramping up in deadliness. We must once again allow our food animals to reproduce on site, on farms, restarting the natural selection that allows immune evolution to track pathogens in real time. In short, many of the very practices the indigenous and smallholders of the world engage in the matter, of course, of their everyday cultivation. So the question is, can we scale these out specific to the needs of people in place around the world? Can we, as the Zapatistas have been paraphrased, can we make un mundo donde quepan muchos mundos, a world where there are many worlds? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rob, for that excellent introduction. Sure to start off a fiery conversation now. So we have here with us today to speak with Rob and to discuss some of these great ideas that he's raised. We have a series of four activists who are working in different communities in different countries around the world. So I'm going to start by handing over to Ari Kurniawati. Ari is joining us from Indonesia, where she's a member of the National Coordinating Council of Solidaridad Perempuan, SP, which is a feminist organization working on gender and human rights with small-scale food providers across Indonesia. And that includes small-scale fishers as well as peasant producers. Ari, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy, and hello, everyone. My name is Ari from Indonesia. Responding to what Rob has already explained, I would like to talk about how the Global South is differently affected, especially in Indonesia. So since the first case were announced in early March 2020, now Indonesia has already more than 5,000 cases reported and around 400 people passed away. The factual number must be higher, considering Indonesian testing capacity. So what are the differences from Indonesia? So first of all, Indonesian people are especially vulnerable to this disease because we still have a lot of cases on tuberculosis and increased number of diabetics. For the poor people, they also tend to ignore health conditions until they become very severe to go to the hospital. It is because of the inaccessible health services in Indonesia. So during the pandemic COVID-19, there is also a lack of medical personnel who can provide also sexual and reproductive health services. So some of cases that reported to us are pregnant women feeling anxious and have to postpone their medical check routine. Of course, this is dangerous because maternal mortality rate in Indonesia is still high. Other vulnerabilities, Indonesia is an archipelago country on the Ring of Fire, which make us experience a number of natural and ecological disaster. Just name it, Jakarta floods, mountain eruption, and even survivors from last year liquefaction in Central Sulawesi currently still live in temporary shelters with poor water and sanitation facilities. The last and most ironic one is actually Indonesia shouldn't need to worry about food crisis because we are very rich on agriculture and fisheries resources. But in fact, food producers, especially the small scale and traditional, keep being threatened by corporate power, land grabbing, extractive industries, coastal reclamation, and other marginalized peasant and fisher from their livelihood. Even amid the pandemic, this project of infrastructure are still ongoing. For women in Indonesia, this situation also a push factor to be a migrant workers without enough protection. And it's been almost a month, my organization documenting the situations from grassroots, not only the impact of COVID-19, but also the impact resulting from policies and actions by authorities or government to address COVID-19. Less than a month until Indonesian people feel the impacts. Policies and action by the government are very biased toward the middle class. They do not consider that people in Indonesia are very diverse. Physical distancing, or we call it as large-scale restriction that have recently been implemented in some big cities in Indonesia, already result millions of people to lose jobs. Of course, this is not includes includes the precarious work. This is some kind of the formal jobs, and traditional markets also have no support from the government to implement the protocol of safety. So it is easily labeled as a non-hygiene and harmful. So for people who able to swift, they tend to swift to modern market, and we. we know that in Indonesia, in the in traditional market in Indonesia, mostly women are sellers and buyers. And in the coastal village, fish market also have been closed by a lot of local government. So women are finding it difficult to sell their fish and shells. And we also record that with these difficulties in economic aspect also increased domestic violence experienced by women. Meanwhile, the government is stuttering resolve this situation. People, not surprisingly, are more alert to build collective action and solidarity. There are several initiatives that already exist, such as connecting between rural and urban regarding the food supplies. Also, we can barter what is the necessity of the people among the rural and also in the urban. And also, some of village rebuilt their food barns in the village to anticipate food prices. And also, some of SP members in the community monitors the distribution of social aid package from the government, since usually happen corruption. And actually, the reallocate budget, it is not coming from, so the government reallocate budget from the village empowerment and education slot then to the military forces. And for Indonesia, we almost have a martial law, because the government thought that the people are not able to control, because they asked to be stay at home and they still going out because they still need to find their livelihood. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ari. Thank you for sharing those insights and those stories from the communities that you're working on. I'm going to pass on now to Moayed Bisharat. Moayed is joining us from Palestine, where he works with the Union of Agricultural Workers Committees, UAC, in focusing especially in the Jordan Valley, his work. UAC works with marginalized small-scale producers across Palestine, and they're a member of the international global peasants movement, La Via Campesina. Moayed's work deals with a number of different issues related to this and to the topic of the webinar, which includes sustainable development, commercialization of seed, access to land for small farmers, and agroecology, among others. Moayed, thank you very much for joining us today, and welcome.
Thank you very much for all participants. First of all, I will talk about the geopolitical situation in occupied Palestinian territories, just to let the all participants to know how is the situation under occupation and under the COVID-19. In the beginning, it's Palestine. It's like after 1948 occupation is divided to three geographical areas. The first one, which is like what called now Israel, which is totally controlled by Israeli occupation authorities. The second one, which is West Bank, which is like 18% of historical Palestine. And Gaza Strip, as you know, which is like the most crowded area in the world. According to the West Bank, the situation, according to Oslo Agreement in 1993, it divided to three areas, Area A and B and C. Area C, it's under the Israeli control, the total Israeli administrative and security control, which form more than 63% of whole West Bank. In Area C, the most agricultural land for the Palestinian, for the food production, is in Area C. And we have like 95% of productive land in Area C. And in Area C, there is more than 300,000 Palestinian live under marginalized and very vulnerable condition. All of this is controlled by the Israeli occupation authorities. Under the international law, the Israel as occupying power, they should to take their responsibilities, to take the care of the health and everything related to people under occupation. But according to this, Israel didn't commit for the international law and for everything. And according to that, we have now under the COVID-19 that the Palestinian their life are threatened because many settlers in the Israeli settlement inside West Bank, they have infection of COVID-19. And they can spread it quickly with through Palestinian. And the Israeli didn't want to close these territories between the Israeli settlement and the Palestinian one. According to OAC, OAC is the Union of Agricultural Work Committee, is a Palestinian grassroots organization. OAC, as a member of Lavaya Campesina, which is the international peasant movement, since 1986, OAC established and started to work with as a grassroots organization with the farmers and small scale peasants in all West Bank and Gaza Strip to support them and support their steadfastness against the agribusiness, against the commercialization of the seeds. And OAC started in 2003 to collect the seeds, the local seeds from the farmers, and to start to do the first conversation place for the local seeds. In the COVID-19 situation, current situation, OAC start to make a campaign to support and to stand up with the farmers and especially the marginalized families, which is the lack of the health support from the Palestinian authority, or the marginalized according to the Israeli restriction and Israeli occupation policy. We start to make a campaign. The campaigns have many levels. The first level, we're working to support the farmers and the families to go back to their land, to cultivate their gardens. So we distribute 350,000 vegetable seedlings to get the farmers or the families to cultivate the gardens and to produce their own healthy food without depending on the commercial and chemical production, which is produced from agribusiness. On the other hand, we support the herding community and Bedouin community in the marginalized area with thousands of hygiene kits to deal with COVID-19. And we continue in our campaign to support the farmers and very poor families. And on the other hand, as all of world maybe know about the Gaza Strip, since 2007, they are under blockade from the Israeli occupation authorities, and they cannot go out or enter the Gaza Strip. So it's like a big prison, and it's controlled totally by the Israelis. They live in very bad condition. The health status is very, very weak. And we are now, there is no more infection or cases in Gaza Strip, but generally, the health status in Gaza Strip is very weak. According to the, on the other hand, for the Palestinian Authority, we're talking about the neoliberal policy or privatization. The small-scale farmers or the poor families, they didn't have the enough money or the financial capacity to cover their primary healthcare. So to go to like to private hospital or to go to private clinic to go with like normal health check, it's very expensive and it's not covered. And as I told in the beginning, like the majority of the marginalized families in Area C, and in Area C, which is, we didn't have one hospital, for Palestinian hospital. So the distance between these areas and the Palestinian city, it's very far. And the people, they are threatened of infection because the Israeli restriction, the Israeli military checkpoint between the areas. So these neoliberal policies or privatization affecting even the small-scale farmer. the as we talking about the general, what Rob talking about, this is like a pandemic war between like China and the USA, but this is the capitalism. This is the yani, the basic mentality of them. They didn't care about the humanity. They didn't care about the small scale farmer. They want to just to earn money. They prepare everything to destroy the beautiful planet, the Earth. And the most vulnerable people will be the farmer. But the farmer stand up in this pandemic, and they produce more and more healthy food to feed the planet. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Moed, for sharing those struggles, and also for ending on a note which I think will feed very well into our next intervention. We're going to go now to Paula Joya. Paula is a small-scale farmer and beekeeper joining us from Germany. Paula is originally from urban Brazil, but began pursuing farming after moving to Germany. Paula's active with ABL. I'm not going to try my German pronunciation on this, but ABL is the German member organization of La Via Campesina. And also, Paula is also active with the European coordination of Via Campesina and the International Coordinating Committee. So she's going to speak with us about the international work of Via Campesina, as well as the situation in Germany. Paula, thank you very much.
Hello, everyone. Thanks very much to TNI for organizing this timely webinar series, and also for inviting us to share our current context in Europe, especially right now. I think, first of all, we need to, or it's good to do a short description how agriculture in Europe has been structured over the past decades. It's an agriculture model which actually is very industrialized, and which is actually feeding corporations, feeding labor exploitation, human rights violations, losses of biodiversity, animal diseases, and so on. At the same time, there are 95% of farms in Europe, which are small or middle scale farms, and those farms are actually also feeding local population with fresh and healthy food, beyond the long supply chains and beyond supermarket chains as well. However, even in times of Corona, what we face is that peasant agriculture is under threat, by globalization and by international markets. Therefore, I would like to go into some impacts that we have been observing or facing over the 6 weeks, more or less, of the pandemic in Europe. First of all, the issue of accessing markets. Peasant farmers in Europe are facing nowadays bigger difficulties than we normally have to access the markets, due to, for example, the closure of most public markets, like in Spain, in Italy, in France, the closure of canteens, the closure of restaurants, limitations on direct sales, and of course also even in the current situation, the increased concentration of food trade in large supermarkets. So this represents huge losses, economical losses for us. Especially, for example, last weekend we had Easter holidays in Europe, and in several countries, not only in Europe but also here. And many small-scale meat producers make their main annual living during this period, And now they lost quite a lot income, and this may already represent the end of many small-scale food producers here in the continent, right? Good news, on the other hand, is that direct sales through consumers, cooperatives, shopping groups, community-supported agriculture, and even through open-air peasants markets, which are still allowed to run, have been proven to be resilient marketing strategies. And the third aspect, or the third impact I would like to highlight here, the second one is the aging of European farmers. No, with European farmers have an average age of 65 years old. This makes our sector, of course, COVID-19 measures in relation to people over 65 years old, cause extra difficulties for them, for example, regarding delivering of their produce or accessing the fields. No, the issue of accessing the fields don't relate only to elder people. No, there is in general difficulties to access the fields in context of lockdowns, because lockdowns measures, they are normally designed, let's say, for the urban areas, no? But in the rural context, and especially in agriculture context, not always the farm and the house are in the same place. So in a lockdown context, many of us cannot access the working place anymore. In that case, there is no option for home office, right? And the third aspect, and the last one I would like to highlight, is that Western Europe has an industrial agriculture structure pretty much based on waged work. No, many of them are seasonal migrants who sadly end up accepting very poor working conditions, right? And the situation is right now even more aggravated. No, in many cases they are facing dangerous health and safety conditions, as well as the reduction of their labor rights, for example, through longer working days. So there are many other impacts. No, this is just a short list. But in general, I would say that these developments impact not only our existence as smallholder food producers, but actually the right to food and nutrition of our entire population, and I hope that in the next round I can go through some other points. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Paola. Thank you, and yes, we will try to come back with a bit more time to share some of our thinking about the solutions and ways forward. So finally, I would like to go to Saisam Khan. Saisam is a PhD researcher working on commodity and land rushes at the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague. He's originally from Northeast Myanmar and has worked for 16 years with Meta Development Foundation, a national NGO in Myanmar, with whom he worked on issues relating to rural development and humanitarian crisis in Myanmar. His work has been wide-ranging and has covered issues like the land rights of ethnic minority and displaced people, agroecological farming, food sovereignty, resource rights, but also illicit drug policies, foreign investment and mega development projects, among others. So bringing a very wide perspective from Myanmar for us today. So Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Katie and TNI, for organizing this. Hello to the audience. Thank you to Rob and friends for your very important inputs and updates. I'll try to update about the situation in Myanmar and the inequality and challenges that I'm seeing. I think a lot of the issues are being said by other colleagues before. There are a lot of similarity and parallels. So far, Myanmar has 74 cases confirmed positive and 4 people has died, unfortunately. And that is out of 53 million people. And as many have said, this might not be reflecting the real situation because of our testing capacity. It looks small compared to other countries, but there is also a very deep-rooted and I would say a reasonable mistrust to the government and the healthcare capacity of our country. So there is a panic reaction among the general public. For the time being, in the big cities, there is a lockdown up until 19th of April. But yeah, social distancing is a very difficult idea for a lot of the people, culturally and also for many reasons. And there is also a lot of concern about the wage labors and, you know, a lot of the rural population, how are they going to make their everyday living in such a situation? And yeah, unfortunately, we are also seeing the rise of xenophobia. And also again, very unfortunately, the migrant workers returning from Thailand and China are also being vilified. We have about 4.25 million migrant workers working in our neighboring countries, about 3 million in Thailand, and about 200,000 in China. The quarantine plan that Myanmar government has prepared is targeted for those who are coming back via airport and not for the those who are returning from the border area. And by the end of March, around 75,000 people are returning from Thai-Myanmar border, and we don't have any capacity to accommodate them in our quarantine facility. So after a simple temperature check, they are allowed to go back home and advise to self-quarantine, but there is no overview or regulatory system to that. And this is kind of like a class blind intervention, I would say, as a state intervention. But on the other hand, Myanmar government also tried to support food aid for those who have difficulty. But then the way the aid is distributed, how it is organized, is being very much criticized among the public. Meanwhile, the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, the state councillor, started to use an official Facebook account and directly communicating with the general public daily. I think this is very much welcome in terms of public communication, but there is more needed to be done. More strategic intervention is needed. Many hospitals doesn't have sufficient PPE, protective gears, and other medical supplies. And also many parts of the country doesn't have access to healthcare. And this is very serious. And she recently pleaded the general public to be more compassionate to the victims and to each other. However, the government that she is leading has banned internet in the in some townships in the western part of Myanmar, in Rakhine and Chin State, where there is a very violent conflict going on. And people need information to fight COVID-19 as well as to survive the violent conflict. In March alone, we have seen over 100 civilians killed by the indiscriminate air raid and mortar shelling. And humanitarian aid in many areas is very difficult to get access. And in the meantime, because of the conflict situation, over 800,000 people are displaced in Rakhine, Kachin, Chin, Shan, and Karen state across the country. They are in a very vulnerable situation in this pandemic. So is the 1 million Rohingya population in the refugee camps in Bangladesh? Civil society organization in Myanmar, the general public are trying to do as much as they can. The civil society organization demand immediate cessation of conflict. And yeah, there is a lot of public mobilization and donation going on. China also sent a medical team and they are providing support, and we are very much appreciate for that. But in the meantime, we are also noticed that China has a very overt strategic, economic and political interest in the country. And yeah, dependency is one of the concerns that we have. To conclude, conflict, land grab, dispossession, migration, all of these are linked. And it's very important to look into dealing with this kind of pandemic situation. So this is from me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sazam. Thank you for that. And thank you to all of the panelists for these excellent interventions and for giving us a sense of how incredibly diverse the impacts of both the pandemic itself are right now, but also the impacts of the different actions taken by governments and the way that these are impacting small-scale food producers and the people who rely on them for their food. We're going to come back now to Rob to offer us a few more brief reflections in response to what we've heard here. And then we will go to questions from the audience. I'm pleased to say that we have won a little bit of time. Thank you to everyone for keeping so diligently to your time limits. So we should have time for a little bit more discussion after. We'll continue until 5:30 today. So thank you very much, Rob.
I'm going to keep my comments brief, but I will say that a few things that came to mind listening to the panelists is that from Moyad's and Ari's presentations, but all the panelists, clearly the world and its politics were here before the outbreak. They helped bring about the outbreak. Outbreaks aren't just merely a matter of contingency. It isn't just a matter of a particular pathogen that happened to be there. The way things are structured now, the politics, both at the local stage and on the global stage, are very much shaping which pathogens make it through the filter and out onto the world travel network as pandemics. Emergencies like an outbreak or a pandemic are very much dependent on their structural causes. And not only before the outbreak, but during an outbreak, very much during the emergency. So in order to get us out of this emergency, and those that will follow this, we must address the structural inequalities now as part of dealing with the emergency itself. And you know, bigger picture, and all the panelists address this, and Paula's and Saysam's intervention spoke about what farmers are doing and the specifics of how to respond to the emergency itself. But clearly, farmers and fisher folk are heavily involved in acting as agents of historical change, not only in their local areas, but on the global stage. Agribusiness has, in essence, attempted to capture the story of food in such a way that much of the world thinks with their premises. And many of us who are interested in a different kind of agriculture have, in essence, acted in some circles in a most on our back heels, trying to push back against that. And we may be in a better position to now strike forward to try to reestablish what is the story of food in such a way that food is not an industrial economy. It's very much part of the natural economy. It involves the sun, the soil, the life cycles of animals, the health and welfare of communities. And I think as we gravitate toward understanding this, we need to help or put smallholders and fisher folk in a position to be able to speak to us and teach us and to tell us, in essence, to return back to Earth to heal what's called the metabolic rift. That's the divide between the ecologies and economies that are causing and driving the worst of the emergence of the pathogens. And I think that it extends into our politics. Clearly, there's been a divide between the urban and rural, and we need to somehow repair that divide in such a way that the welfare of our brothers and sisters in rural areas are very much connected to the health and welfare of people in the living in the cities. And we need to start to expand out into our ways of thinking and strategizing how to heal that rift as well. And of course that extends, and I'll end up in this way, it extends onto the world stage. The pandemic has very much told us, as most of the world already knows this, that the health and welfare of each of us is connected to each one of us around the world, and particularly and very explicitly the divide between the global north and the global south. That has to be addressed. There's an unequal ecological exchange going on where the global north extracts entirely the resources and labor from the Global South, and that has to end. And I mean, that is indeed, in my view, the crux and the push of the emergence of multiple pathogens coming out of that. And if we in the North, we who are on our couches in New York City or here in St. Paul coughing up our lungs, must understand that we have arrived at this position by virtue of the policies we've supported that has, in essence, put countries around the world and peoples around the world in such a bind that the local practices, in essence, also supplied by capital from abroad, from centers of capital like New York, London, and Hong Kong, have in essence pushed the development and deforestation that, in essence, led to the spillover of these new pathogens. And I think on a personal note, it's really a difficult path to be able to speak in its context here from the U.S., who has been, in essence, a primary driver of some of the worst practices around the world, indeed has, in essence, supported the occupations and dictatorships in each of the other panelist countries. It's very difficult to be able to speak to that in a way that's to say, I'm not a representative of the American people, but I do extend from us our apologies for these terrible things that our country has done that has, in essence, put us all in a bind and clearly has destroyed many people's populations' lives and livelihoods for many, many decades. And now, clearly, perhaps we could see this as here up in the Global North to understand that our welfare, well-being is very much tied into the state and well-being of people in the Global South.
Thank you very much, Rob, for those thoughts, those insights, and thank you to all of the panelists. So I think we've had an amazing broad perspective here, and we've had people sharing, I think, several hundred questions with us for all of the panelists. We're going to pull out just a few of those and ask you to answer them, and I will just pose a few questions up front and then hand off to all of you one after another once again and ask you to take, in fact, we're quite good for time, so you can take 3 or 4, maybe even almost 5 minutes to share some responses to these questions. You don't need to touch on everyone, but some responses, and as well as any final closing thoughts. I think we won't have time for one final circuit, so I will ask you just to wrap up with a closing thought if there's something that you want to leave people with at the end of the webinar to take away with them. So quite a lot of the questions that we've gotten have been trying to drill in on this question of the strategies, the solutions, the next steps. I think in all of the interventions, we can see a general trend, although people correct me if they disagree, but a trend that the kind of interventions that are currently being pursued are mostly leaning towards deepening the kinds of inequalities and structural problems which help to give rise to the current crisis, and to consolidating industrialized, unequal capitalist food systems. But we have also heard some inspiring examples of different alternatives and ways in which people are pushing for more just food systems, which can tackle some of the structural issues behind the current pandemic. So we'd really like to try to take some of this, this time in the last session, to unpack some of those. So some of the questions that we have had come through from our audience are, do we see, or how do we see, in the face of this threat that we all are confronting globally, do we also see an opportunity to push forward more transformative visions of a food system for food sovereignty? And what kind of situations do you see, and especially in your local context, for pushing a food sovereignty agenda? At the same time, second question, closely related though, what kind of strategies do you see for reducing the power of international agribusiness and for reclaiming the food system as a democratic space and as a space for us, really? And related to that, we have seen agribusiness already trying to make an argument that the kind of food they provide is safer, as Ari mentioned, with the closure of local markets. There's a and Paula, there's a tendency to cast the industrial food as sort of sanitary and safer, and how do we as food movements respond to and address that kind of challenge? And maybe last of all, as we see associated with the pandemic, an increasing economic crisis, what do we see as opportunities from that? And how do we see that food systems might be part of a solution to rebuild the an economy in a vision of, as Rob has said elsewhere, a vision of a world where internationalism overcomes globalization? So just a few small questions, 2 or 3 minutes should be plenty. I will pass on first to Ari to ask you to share some of your thoughts on those questions and on the final takeaway for people to take with them today.
Okay, I think this pandemic also become a turning point to show that the initiative coming up from the grassroots really an initiative that really a solution. It's not about the alternative one, but it is something that we already have. This is our sovereignty, and this is something that can be very a solution for the recent situation here, because the solidarity, because we have our own knowledge, we have our own practices. So this is something that we can show that the solidarity among the people, it's really work, and we don't need any agribusiness anymore, actually. Yeah, so that is the thing. I'm afraid that if the government specifically still thinking as business as usual, so it will not be changing anything. I'm afraid of that. So it has become a very consolidated movement among the people on the ground to showing and to expressing their demands. I think so.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ari. So we'll go through in the same order as the previous session. So I'll hand over now to Muayyad to share some of his thoughts on the solutions and the strategic opportunities right now.
The situation, I think it's given like opportunity to let the all the people to go back to their land, to cultivate as, to prove that the alternative solution, which is like the agroecology, is the solution for as alternative solution for the agribusiness, to produce more and more healthy food for the people, and to get rid of capitalism and its investment between our lands. In general, I'm talking about all the farmers or all the peasants in the world, not just in Palestinian territories. On the other hand, we're talking about the governments. It should take their responsibility to support the small-scale farmers, to support the vulnerable families, because the neoliberal policies, which is came from the government and the capitalism in general, this is the main cause of the poverty between these vulnerable communities in Palestine and elsewhere. So the government should take their responsibility. The private sector should take their responsibility in this crisis. But the opportunity is like to all the people, even farmer or not farmer, they can go back to their lands, which like even the small space of land, to cultivate, to plant it with their local seeds, to grow more and more and produce healthy food for our community and for our families. In other hand, we should, like the slogan of La Valle Campesina, we should globalize the struggle. This struggle is a global struggle against the capitalism. We are, as a people in general, we are affected by the capitalism, the neoliberal policies. So we should come with the, and this is the opportunity to become, to make a solidarity for all the human in this planet, to take that the humanity is like the our priority, not to to earn and more money. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ma'ed, for that that call to collective action and to global solidarity. I'd like to pass on now to Paula.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, in terms of next steps, no, I think there are some immediate steps to be done in terms of measures that policymakers have to do. For example, to guarantee the mobility of small-scale food producers to their fields, to their meadows, to their waters, and also to the markets. No. Secondly, in terms of agriculture, we demand as European coordination via Campesina that all European Union countries advance the common agriculture policy payment, subsidies payment for 2020, and also that that smallholder food producers who faced losses now during the crisis, that they also have tax reductions, so they can financially overcome the losses of the past weeks and guarantee the upcoming sowing and harvest season. And thirdly, in terms of short term, we need, of course, to guarantee health safety for smallholder food producers and also for land workers in the fields and also in local markets. Now, looking a bit further ahead, no? We need, of course, public policies that can guarantee a generational renewal in European agriculture. No? So public policies to support new entrants into agriculture. And we need to finally step down from this model where we have a large-scale animal production, which is already shown to be much more vulnerable to infections, to contribute to climate change, which is exploiting nature and also the labor and so on. No, and then we need, of course, to develop measures to guarantee local health, healthy and sustainable food production in the hands of small-scale food producers. At fair prices. No, and here it's already the opportunity. I think this crisis, as Mojad already said, is a great opportunity to make food sovereignty a living reality, right? So the crisis reopens us the opportunity to increasingly highlight the importance of food sovereignty as a key path, as Via Campesina and Allies have been actually already pushing forward since 1996, right? So and it's also time, I think, to strengthen our alliances and also to build new ones, no? Between urban and rural areas, between the different food producers, the different civil society sectors, and so on. So we can really, strengthen our movement for the urgently needed social and systemic transformation. And therefore, I would like to already make a call for action here. The 17th of April is our historical International Day of Peasant Struggles. It's the next Friday. And Via Campesina, of course, is calling this year again for mass mobilizations, but this time not on the streets, no. But we are calling to stay home, but not silent. So please check our website, our social media channels, and mobilize with us in solidarity with peasants, but actually for a social struggle that belongs to the whole society. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paula, and thank you for highlighting some of those new possible alliances that can come out of this moment of crisis and of struggle. I'd like to pass now to Saisan.
Thank you, Katie. As many panelists have already pointed out, I think international solidarity is what is very much needed. Not only that, regional as well as national solidarity and working together is needed. And as a humanity, this kind of crisis is not for the first time, and I'm sure we will overcome it. But to take this also as an opportunity to change the things, to the things that we want to see change. Especially for the Myanmar, the civil society organization are trying to do whatever they can. The general public is trying to help. And, you know, we have seen since 2008, devastating Cyclone Nargis response. The state alone cannot deal with this kind of crisis. And then they need to allow the public to meaningfully engage there. So we need to stop the conflict immediately. We need to stop banning of internet and targeting the media. I think a civic space is all the more very important in such time. And also for the international community, especially for like China or for Japan and other investment, mining, big industries, they really have to rethink and take more responsibility of what they are doing. And as a civil society organization in Myanmar, we are trying to also push forward the food sovereignty movement. With the climate change threat coming, this is the only way that we can go forward to ensure sustainability. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much, Sazam. Thank you for that. And now I will hand over to Rob for our last word and for a response to some of these questions about where we go next and how we operationalize some of the great ideas that we've been sharing here today.
Oh, also such easy questions. I just want to say, like, you know, I think what climate change and the pandemic indicates that we are indeed at a profound historical moment, in essence, a precipice over which, notions, terrible possibilities of civilizational collapse. I'm not a prepper at all or anything like that, but we're in some deep trouble. And indeed, in part because, in essence, our planet is largely controlled by a class of sociopaths who think that, in essence, that we can, in essence, engage in capitalist accumulation as if there's a total, as if people were things, and people can, and their labor can be smashed and thrown away as anything else as a product, and also that there is an infinite number of supply of resources through which we can just burn right through and expect no consequences. And these are rulers right now, and they're sociopaths, and somehow we're going to have to break their command of the planet. And that is, of course, a generational project. I mean, it's going to be something that we can't do next week or anything, although it's a good time to start. But it's something that's going to require indeed the total reversal of the present power dynamics. That extends from, yes, immediate tactics of what do we do in the course of the constraints that we are now presently operating. But as we understand that agribusiness is in essence opposed to public health as a matter of principle, I mean, externalize all its costs of production onto everybody else, onto the animals themselves or the crops, the local environments, the labor, the local wildlife, all to be able to clear a certain profit margin at the end of the quarter. So in essence, that command has to be broken in order for us to get to the promised land of an agroecology and generative agriculture that in essence reties and reconfigures ecologies back in a way that inputs and outputs are speak to each other in such a way that we can continue to live on this planet from generation to generation. If, however, we continue on this path by which we are going to, in essence, continue to pretend we can operate in this fashion and continue to offload the worst of the damage onto the rest of the planet, other peoples, then there comes to a point where that system collapses under its own weight and it takes everybody out from underneath them. The rise of empires are terrible things, and the collapse of empires are terrible things. The question, of course, is that, you know, can we cycle out of this a mode of production and way of being to a place where, in essence, we reintroduce ourselves to Earth and, in essence, return to the planet that we presently walk on? This sounds like a contradiction, but if we are alienating our means by which we grow food or produce anything, we in essence destroy the very planet and peoples upon which we depend on to be able to consist to persist as a species. I think it's very critical that yes, the specifics are very important in terms of logistics of how do we maneuver in the constraints. But I think we should be proud of thinking in terms of the bigger picture of what the profound shift in the very nature of our relationships to each other and to the planet that are going to be required if we're going to do anything about climate change and the coming pandemics.
Thank you very much, Rob. Thank you for those inspiring words to leave us with and to remind us that although this is a terrible moment, it's not a moment to let our courage fail us or to lower our ambitions, but that instead we need to try to seize the opportunities that present themselves and push for the kind of transformative change that many of our movements have been pushing for all along. In a perhaps first in my career with TNI, I believe that we finished slightly early. So thank you very much to everybody for their extremely insightful and concise contributions. And I'd like to, so therefore, Jess, I will ask you to go on to my last slide already. And I will say thank you to all of you for joining us. Thank you very much to all of you for joining us and for sharing your thoughts and your contributions. And we will, of course, keep in touch. There has been a huge amount of engagement in the chat. And you will see there's also some engagement on social media. So we invite you to join in that conversation subsequently if you have the time and the energy and the possibility. So my slide showing here now, this is a closing image that we wanted to leave you with from this webinar today, although it's not entirely an optimistic one. You've been seeing this image as a background theme in some of the slides today and perhaps hearing it as a background theme in some of the presentations. But I wanted to share with you the original image. This is a painting by the Filipino painter Boy Dominguez, which has been titled, "We Are Not All in the Same Boat, and Some of Us Don't Even Have a Boat." This was something which resonated with us as we were pulling together this webinar and drove some of our thinking around it. And what we hoped to discuss today, among other things, was the different ways in which this crisis is impacting everyone and the fact that while we are all struggling in the same stormy sea, we are not, in fact, in the same boat. However, I believe and I hope that our panelists today have helped to show us some ways that we might at least start all swimming together for the shore. So thank you very much to everyone for joining us. Thank you to the audience and thank you to my panelists. I'll give you a little bit of information still about the coming webinars, so don't leave me quite yet. Thank you also to the TNI team for all of their organizational support, as well as to AIDC and Focus on the Global South, who co-sponsored this webinar. Our webinar next week will be, again, picking up on the theme of the current crisis. We'll be taking health back from corporations, big pharma, privatized health, pandemics, and popular resistance. And you can register for this via our website now, and the link should go up in the chat. And I am very pleased to announce that that webinar will be featuring Susan George, TNI's founder. We also will have an Arabic language webinar next week. That will be next Tuesday, so on the 21st of April. And it will be the Corona pandemic and the necessity of the struggle for sovereignty over food and resources in North Africa. Finally, on the 29th of April, we will have another webinar treating the authoritarian responses to the crisis. And we will continue with the weekly webinars after that. So we invite you, please, to go ahead and contact us with your ideas for future webinars that you'd like to see. You can reach out by email to Jess. And Jess has already put up for us a short poll where you can also share some other kinds of events or feedback on some other kinds of events that you might be interested in engaging with as we keep trying to figure out how we can continue organizing in this very altered context. So please do respond to the poll. Finally, yes, as Paula mentioned, and I wanted to reiterate, this Friday will be the International Day of Peasant Struggles. So please do feel free to engage or be welcome to engage online in those campaigns. And you can find more information in the websites shared. Thank you, Paula. And just to say that in order to make sure you don't miss other future events, you can also register for the TNI newsletter. And if you found our session today useful, please do consider donating via our website as well to help us cover some of the costs of organization. So thank you once again to everyone for joining us. We'll leave the chat open for a little bit so that you can wrap up your conversations there. And I wish you all a good day or good evening or good afternoon. And thank you to everyone and thank you to the panelists.